Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. James Pagel about sleeping and dreams, which I think is, you know, fascinating. Christy, you ever dream?
Oh, yes. And I can't, I'm going to have to hold back the temptation to tell him about all my dreams.
Right. It'll be therapy for Christy and I as we tell him about our dreams and what it really means. But maybe it'll be this opportunity to hear about your dreams as our listeners and understand a little bit better about the role of dreams in sleeping. But first, Christy, we have some research that matters that really, I think, is important for people, particularly in this season of vaccinations.
It is. And it is the flu season now. So it's appropriate that we're talking about some studies related to that. The first one is about vaccines and autism. And Adam, I'm sure this is true for you, but so many of my patients are concerned, rightly so as mothers, about any potential link between shots and autism.
Yeah. And let's just say off the bat, this study confirms what most other really good research has, that there is not a link between pediatric vaccines, in this particular case, the mercury in those vaccines and autism. And this was a very good study that was in the journal Pediatrics just recently.
It is. And it really just added to the evidence that we have that this thimerosal, which is a mercury preservative that used to be in a lot of vaccines, does not increase a child's risk of autism.
Right. And a lot of people who get real concerned, and you still can get thimerosal-free vaccination. Mm-hmm. However, there's no evidence that this preservative has led or is responsible for any increase in autism. And this was a research that the Centers for Disease Control looked at for children born between 1994 and 1999. And they looked at a whole bunch of children who came down with autism and compared them with a whole bunch of children who didn't have autism.
And they found that no matter when a child had been exposed to this thimerosal, whether it was during pregnancy when the mother had a shot or when the child got his or her own shots, there was no increased risk of any type of autism spectrum disorder. So that's very, very reassuring.
Yeah. So the bottom line here is for us that, you know, you can safely give your child vaccinations, particularly any that has thimerosal, without worry that this is linked to autism. These reports are going to continue because the one report that showed a link, 12 cases, that research has been discredited. It's been pulled off the internet. But those people who still want to believe this, it'll still stay out there. But we are saying that the research does not support that.
And the shots, there's lots of research to show that the immunizations do protect from scary illnesses. So
let's transition, Christy, and talk about another type of vaccination right now that I think is on everyone's minds, particularly given the flu season is really just getting underway here, and that's the flu vaccination. And I think we're going to look at two research here that we haven't really talked a lot about before, but it's, is the flu vaccination help you actually have reduced heart attacks? And then also, what does it mean for pregnant women getting the flu shot? What's the first study?
The first one is about a lower heart attack risk from getting the flu shot. This is fascinating to me that the vaccine might actually do more than just prevent the flu. And
in this
study, they looked at a lot of people, 78,000 patients and a lot of different family practices, and found a 19% reduction in the rate of a first heart attack.
Yeah, and it seemed what was interesting is if you got the flu shot earlier in the fall, kind of like now rather than, you know, January or February, that it really had a better benefit. This was the flu vaccination where you found the benefit, not from the pneumococcal vaccination. So everyone should be getting their flu vaccinations and they may get some benefits.
Absolutely. And I mean, this was in patients who didn't have any known heart disease, but there was a reduction of that first heart attack in people who didn't have any heart disease to begin with.
So, well, and we know that if you get a severe respiratory infection, that there's a chance that you may end up getting a heart attack because it puts such a strain on the body and decreases oxygen flow to the heart. So this is actually really pretty impressive, I think, and it adds to the reason that really everyone who is indicated, which is almost everyone nowadays, should be getting flu shots every year.
Absolutely. And now, speaking of everyone, that also includes pregnant women. And so this is information from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or OBGYN, that has issued a new recommendation. It's not new to say pregnant women should get the flu shot, but this is a recommendation to doctors that we really do a better job of urging our patients to get that flu shot.
Yeah, I think in the past we kind of recommended it to pregnant women, but maybe we weren't as aggressive enough in recommending it. And so therefore, a very small minority of pregnant women actually get a flu shot. Rates as low as 25% of pregnant women will actually have gotten it. And that's actually ends up really causing too much people getting sick, because when pregnant women get the flu, it can have disastrous consequences for them and even their child, unborn child.
Absolutely. Pregnant women are more susceptible to getting very sick from the flu, more likely to be in the hospital. And there's a high percentage of the deaths that happen from H1N1 that happened in pregnant women. So
from that swine flu. And nowadays, the vaccination we're giving this year has protection against both the swine flu and the regular flu.
Mm-hmm. So if you are pregnant or you know someone who's pregnant, it is important to get the flu shot when you are pregnant. It's important for everyone.
And it's safe. And just speaking of, there's no evidence that thimerosal actually also is damaging to pregnant women at all either. So, again, I think this is something that we're encouraging. There's additional research and authorities recommending it.
All right.
Let's move on to one last topic here, Christy, which is one that's near and dear to me, as you know, but it's about smoking cessation. And there's this new treatment out there for the 46 million Americans that's being promoted to them to help them quit smoking. And the question is, does this treatment work?
So if you're trying to stop smoking, you might have heard about this laser therapy that's out there. There's a Connecticut-based company that advertises that this works. It's pretty expensive, like $350 for a treatment to get lasers pointed at these specific acupuncture points to try to help people quit smoking.
Yeah, and we know from past research that acupuncture or auriculotherapy, which is acupuncture of the ear, has been used for a long time in trying to treat addictions. And we know, unfortunately, that the evidence doesn't work, that it actually helps people eventually stay off cigarettes. It may or may not have any benefit in the first 2 or 3 days, but it doesn't last at all. And so the claims by this laser company that a single treatment of lasers can get success rates of 50 to 60% long term, that's what they're claiming in this research.
Well, and there was one study published by the Journal of Chinese Medicine that's available on the website of the company that did show some promise to smokers who had 4 laser treatments over 2 weeks, suggesting that it may help people quit smoking and have success with that. That's a really good thing. But there was also a study that showed no difference. So at this point, we don't really have enough evidence to say whether it helps or not.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those situations, Christy, where first off, there is no free lunch. People think that, oh, I can just go in and get a painless treatment and then I won't have no further problem. And it doesn't usually work that way. And the second, when it seems too good to be true, it usually is. And
yeah,
I think not recommending this to patients who smoke until we see more research that suggests really that it really works. And probably what's going to work is lots of behavioral therapy with our patients.
Well, and your nicotine independence clinic at UNC has good data to support
its effectiveness. 1 year data. You know, what happens 1 year out, not, you know, 1 week out from the treatment. And we show that about 30% of people who go through an intensive program combining medication with behavioral counseling can be smoke-free at the end of a year.
Fantastic.
Well, that's some interesting research today that matters, Christy. I think we've really talked about that. We maybe agree that this laser treatment is not recommended for smoking cessation.
Yep. And that pregnant women should get the flu shot.
And that getting that flu shot also, even if you're not pregnant, will lower your risk of heart attack.
And there is no link between vaccine, mercury, and autism.
Well, hopefully that will be some information that you can use, and that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. James Pagel about sleep and your dreams. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about sleep and dreams. And as a person who loves to both sleep and to dream, I am excited about this conversation, Adam. So many of us are interested in our dreams, and we have a lot of patients who ask us about sleep problems or ask us about memory problems and perhaps even dreams. So we know that a lot of people out there will be interested in this conversation.
Yeah, and I think with a renewed interest in dreams, which everyone just about seems to have experience with, good or bad, throughout their lives, in the latest film on Inception that's spread around the United States. We're really fortunate today that we actually have a medical expert in research on dreams and sleep issues, Dr. James Pagel, to be with us on Conversations. Dr. Pagel is an associate clinical professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, Family Medicine Residency Program in Pueblo, Colorado, and medical director of the Sleep Disorder Center of Southern Colorado and SleepWorks in Colorado Springs. When I was looking really for someone that could help join us on this, I noticed that he has over 100 publications in the field of sleep and dreams, including several books, Primary Care Sleep Disorders, A Practical Guide, The Limits of Dream, A Scientific Exploration of Mind-Body Interface, and his latest book, Dreams and Nightmares, A Sleep Medicine Review. So welcome to your show, Dr. Pagel.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Pagel, Adam and I love to hear from our guests a little bit about what got you fascinated in the science of dreams and sleep. I can imagine, just based on my own excitement about it, but what got you into this field?
Well, I'm an old guy as far as sleep medicine goes. It's been 35 years, and made the choice of going into family medicine after getting a master's in the neuropharmacology of sleep. And being a family physician, I had a little bit of lifestyle quality issues and ended up in Hawaii, where I didn't have a sleep lab. And I had a lot of people with interest in dreams and developed an aspect of bringing the scientific approach to trying to study dreams.
It's wonderful. You're not going to get a lot of sympathy or empathy having picked this up in Hawaii, but and you're now in this beautiful Colorado. But, you know, it's interesting because dreams go back to antiquity and the description of dreams throughout the Bible and experiences about them. But if we just start at a real basic level, how do you, as a scientist and a researcher, when you say a dream, what does that mean to you?
Well, that's been a real question, and a lot of the research, if you go into dreams, can be written about things that there's almost a real confusion about what you're talking about. There are people who believe that, like most sleep medicine physicians, that a dream is a level of feeling, thought, or emotion that's described from during sleep. However, we have a large group of people that were trained in psychoanalytic theory with Freud, etc., who believe that a dream is a bizarre hallucinatory type of mental process that can occur in either sleep or wake. So if you're looking at anything about dreams, it's not a diffuse term. In fact, if you go to the library, it's really, if you look dream up, it'll be dream home, dream wife, this wish fulfillment idea of what a dream is.
Well, if you're trying to study and measure it, but yet we don't understand exactly what it is, how do you approach that?
Well, first you have to decide and interact with the person you're interacting with as to what they think a dream is. Because if you just do it generically, you'll get people with all these different ideas of what a dream is. And that's why that much of the research is somewhat contradictory and doesn't work with each other. There's also been a tendency to get excited about the content, about what is in the dream, and a tendency to try to interpret people's dreams. Many of us now view that the person who's best to figure out what the dream means is the dreamer, his or herself.
Well, I was surprised. I thought when I would go into this that everyone dreams. But apparently reading, that's not necessarily the case. So are there – do we know – are there some people that are more predisposed to dreams and or why? If you're having more stress in your life, are you more likely to dream? Or if you are more content, are you more likely to dream or neither?
Well, there's a wide spectrum in how much people recall their dreams. We've found the rare person who actually never recalls a dream. And it's an interesting group. It's not common. Most people dream throughout their lives. In fact, you can do major damage to the brain, and you can remove half the brain for a seizure reason. And all those individuals will continue to dream. So it's something that we maintain on a long-term level. We do know that we've done several degrees of work with successfully creative people. I work with screenwriters and directors and actors at the Sundance Film Labs, where my wife works. And these folks blow all our scales out. They remember their dreams at a high level, and they incorporate their dreams into their work. So our best data for a use or function of dreams is in creativity, or, as you note, the adaptation to stress, because there's a lot of emotional processing that occurs in association with dreaming.
I want to talk a little bit about recurrent dreams and about safety. So I won't have you give me your analysis of me, but I will share that I've had this recurrent dream since I was young that I can fly. Can only fly when I need to escape from something that's going to cause me harm or to save someone else. And rarely, only once ever, did I fly for fun. There's all these different parts of it, but it just happened throughout my whole life. And it's occurred to me there were times when I was young when I actually thought I could fly when I was a child. And that if I were a person who might blur the lines, and maybe those times will happen for me, that could be dangerous. Do you run into people who blur the dream and reality of recurrent dreams, and are there safety issues there for us to consider?
Well, there are safety issues in a specific group of people, and we do have people who have a diagnosis that's not terribly uncommon called REM behavior disorder. However, it usually occurs in late middle-aged males. That's the most common individual to get it, where there is a loss of the motor block between the dream and the experience of dreaming. And I had a patient not long ago who was having lots of dreams about being a dog and actually bit her husband in the night. So there becomes some danger issues for these folks. It does often occur in association with other sleep disruptive events, such as leg kicks or sleep apnea occurring during the night. So we look for that in the sleep lab, and then we do have medications if this is dangerous, because there are folks who get injured in the middle of the night associated with this REM behavior disorder.
We're talking with Dr. James Pagel. Dr. Pagel, let me ask you a question. You mentioned sleep apnea, and it's certain sleep disorders, and this is a huge underdiagnosed problem. Christy and I have talked about it briefly on the show before, and I know you do a lot of work with sleep apnea. Are dreams influenced by these types of medical problems or other sleep disorders?
Well, one of the problems that happens, what you're talking about with acting out of dream, is called a parasomnia, or a negative behavior associated with sleep. And any event that causes you to wake up multiple times during the night is likely to be more likely to cause something like a parasomnia. The problem is that sleep apnea is incredibly common. We're realizing that it's up to 35% of the people that would come into an adult medical clinic, the people with high blood pressure, with heart failure, with heart rhythm disturbance, with diabetes, with strokes. It turns out that the underlying factor for all of these very common illnesses is often sleep apnea. And it's a correctable diagnosis, but this treatment with CPAP that's not everybody likes, but it has almost no negative side effects to use. So it's a dangerous and physiologic disruptive diagnosis that we look for because it's so common and it's so dangerous.
Yeah. Well, we do need to take a short break, but this is a fascinating conversation. When we return, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. James Pagel. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. James Pagel about dreaming and sleep issues. And before we broke, Dr. Pagel, we had talked a little bit about, you know, dreams that one feels good about and some of the creative process a little bit. We haven't talked about nightmares and bad dreams, the dreams in which one is being chased, or what I've heard is that you can't be killed in a dream, but some people describe that as sometimes I've heard. Tell us a little bit about your research in nightmares and bad dreams.
Well, there's two types of nightmare disturbance. We have individuals who have frequent nightmares, and interestingly, they're often creative personality types. And we find working with screenwriters and directors and actors that they commonly have nightmares, and they often incorporate those into their work. Nightmares can be very disruptive in sleep. In fact, we occasionally will get people with insomnia related to recurrent nightmares, but they can also be useful for these creative types. And then there's the post-traumatic stress disorder patients, and that's become an increasing problem. I work in a community with a high number of returning soldiers, and the most common symptom of PTSD is recurrent nightmares, and it can be a very distressing experience.
And you mentioned earlier that there could be medications to help if people had sleep disorders, but is it possible to train a person through behavioral therapy or something? Is it possible for a person to train yourself not to have bad dreams but to have happy dreams?
Well, there's some very good data for that. Nightmares are quite amenable to behavioral approaches to treatment. It's always best to be in a supportive situation if you're going to attempt to do something like this, because an individual who's having recurrent nightmares, particularly if it's related to trauma, these can come out at times of stress. And it's always good to have a support system in place. But there are imagery therapies, and there's EMDR, which is an eye movement therapy. And both of these have shown very good success in lowering the frequency of nightmares for people who are having a large number of disturbing dreams that are breaking up their sleep.
So when you say imagery therapy, are you talking about a person focusing on certain positive images before they fall asleep?
Well, what we do with folks is get them to bring in an idea of their worst dream ever, which can be, particularly in children, it's often an image of a monster. In PTSD patients, it's often a recurrent image from experience. And have them work with us to change that imagery and focus on a change in that storyline before they go to bed each night.
Wow. Wow. You know, I think one of the issues involved in lots of people is they say, you know, I had a dream, I can't remember it, and it bothers people. You know, in some aspect, there's this real desire to want to remember your dreams. And I remember being told once, I doubt it was by a doctor, but reading maybe somewhere that you should really keep a journal and you know, by your bedside. Does that work? And are there ways to encourage people really to remember their own dreams that can help them figure out some aspects of their subconscious?
Well, you know, there's a big difference in how often people remember dreams. It's higher in women, and it's higher when you're younger. There are these techniques. And they do work. Just talking about dreams means that it's more likely that the listeners to this show are going to remember a dream this night. And starting a dream journal, or there's a very short timeline about losing a dream. So if you get up in the morning and go brush your teeth to focus on something different, you will have very likely forgotten that dream that seemed so vivid when you got up. So if you want to remember your dreams, keep a journal by the bed.
Do you know why? Why is it that if you tell it or you write it down, or if you don't do those things, that you'll forget it? Do you know?
Well, there's different theories, and one of the theories is kind of where the dream is and what the dream means. It may be an experience of something that's so disconnected from our waking conscious reality that it doesn't interface well with our waking memory pattern.
It may not make sense to us in logical order in our normal daytime
and
thinking.
We drop it. There's also a couple of diagnoses that are associated with losing dream recall. And people who get depressed often don't remember dreams as well. And sleep apnea is often associated with a decline in dream recall.
We're talking with Dr. James Pagel, the medical director of the Sleep Disorder Centers of Southern Colorado and the author of several books about dreams and nightmares and sleep. Dr. Pagel, let me ask you a question. You know, people nowadays, there's an explosion of medication used for insomnia, drugs like Ambien and Lunesta and others. How do medications affect dreaming, as well as common substances that people take to sometimes thinking that it is going to help them sleep, like alcohol? How does that affect dreaming?
Well, one of the interesting factors that most people generally don't realize is that rapid eye movement, sleep, and dreaming are very loosely related, that the things that affect REM sleep don't necessarily affect dreaming. So for a long time, we thought that it was only medications affecting rapid eye movement sleep that altered dreaming. Turns out that a large number of medications, both prescription and across the counter, can induce changes in dream recall and changes in nightmares. The most common medication is probably the type 1 antihistamines, such as in Tylenol PM or across-the-counter sleep aids. And for many people,
things like diphenhydramine or Benadryl.
Benadryl, mm-hmm. Yeah. And these meds often cause a change in dreaming. There's a bunch of blood pressure meds, such as propranolol or the Prazosin, which we use to suppress nightmares that alter dreaming. And then almost all of the sleeping pills will induce disordered dreaming or nightmares in some people, as well as the antidepressants.
So just in some people, it might bring on more nightmares, but in other people, it might not have an effect on anything as it relates to dreams?
It's very idiosyncratic. You know, many of these drugs will do it to some people, but definitely they don't do it to everyone. Probably the most common agent causing recurrent nightmares are the diphenhydramine agents.
I know we're going to have to wrap up shortly, but we wanted to be sure to find out what is up and coming for dream research. Like, what are the next things we're going to discover?
Well, one of the interesting areas right now is nightmares and emotional processing. A lot of our treatments currently are about the suppression of nightmares for patients with PTSD. We give them drugs or we use the imagery therapy to make the nightmares go away. And so there is a question of whether returning to old ideas of the creative process and the use of such experiences in art therapy or in personal creative approaches might be a reasonable way to integrate these experiences rather than just trying to suppress them and make them go away.
Fascinating.
I know we're going to be taking a break, but if where do you direct patients to for, you know, the types of things, if they really want to study this in more detail? I know you have a recent book out, and can they Google that or get it on Amazon? And
yeah, if you look up J.F. Pagel, Sleep and Dreams, there's a lot of stuff. There's an International Association for the Study of Dreaming that is a reasonable clearinghouse of people who are trying to understand, at least on a logical manner, dreaming. There's been a huge change in our perspectives in the last few years or our understandings as we talked about definitions, et cetera. And the books on dreaming that used to be 1,000 pages long may only be 150 pages long now, so they're easier to digest.
All right. Well,
that's good for me.
Thank you for processing that for us to distill it down. Thank you, Dr. Pagel, for being with us today.
Hey, you're welcome.
We've been talking with Dr. James Pagel of the University of Colorado. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For House Call segment today, we're going to talk about your questions, experiences, and attitudes.
And no surprise, we want you to write us about your experiences and with your questions. And we have lots of different ways that you can reach us. One is by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And another way is to call us at 919-966-8081. And now we'll have our executive producer, Julie Steiner, read some of the house calls that we have for today.
I am a 52-year-old woman who recently was in a motor vehicle accident. I'm okay, but on my back x-rays, I was told I had something called a syrinx in my spinal cord. They said it would be okay, but this is really scary. What are your thoughts?
Well, first off, we're sorry that you were in a motor vehicle accident. Those things just happen sometimes out of the blue, and they can be life-altering for a lot of people. And clearly, if you had to get x-rays of your back, someone was concerned somewhere that you may have had an injury.
Mm-hmm. And it's also scary to get a diagnosis, especially one like a syrinx that sounds – just the word itself sounds bizarre.
Yeah. And, you know, first off, let's say, you know, this is not a tumor. This is not a cancer in the back, but it is most frequently the result of a cyst or a leakage or something that happens within the spinal cord, as most frequently the result of trauma. And so this certainly could have happened as a result of your motor vehicle accident.
It also can be related with having an infection in your brain or along your spinal cord. There are lots of different reasons to get one of these cysts. But a lot of people have really no problems from it if it stays small, and it may not cause you any problems. But some people do develop some symptoms and need treatment.
And particularly if you start to develop some symptoms, some weakness in an extremity or increasing pain or numbness, the types of things that you'd normally worry about as a result of something in your spinal cord potentially. So knowing that it's there is probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree, Christy, there's unlikely that this is going to impact on you if it hasn't already. And it can be followed pretty closely. And certainly if it does, it sounds like your doctors are right on top of it. So.
Yep. And if you were having symptoms, there's a possibility of draining the fluid out of the cyst or even removing it. But hopefully it won't come to that. So we hope you're feeling better after having that car crash. And thank you for sharing with us.
What's our very next house call, Julie?
I've had an infection that caused me a whole lot of diarrhea with fever and nausea. I got it from my dad, who is now over it. The doctor asked me about blood in the stool, which I said I didn't have, but later on I did notice the stool looked a little red to me. I wanted an antibiotic, but the doctor told me my illness was most likely a virus. What do you think?
Well, I would agree that it is most likely a virus that causes this type of thing.
I'd call your dad up and say, why'd you give me that?
Yeah, exactly.
Blame your dad. Milk it for whatever you can first, and then we'll come back to, you know, what's going on here. Because it clearly was something contagious.
Right.
I mean, I do think you did get it from your dad. If he had the symptoms, then you got the symptoms. I mean, you know, that's probably true.
And in most cases, an antibiotic could even make it worse, since antibiotics, you know, one of the side effects is that it can cause diarrhea, so you might feel worse with an antibiotic.
And then some of the things that, one of the things that, you know, we think about and that maybe you're hearing about is something called salmonella. And salmonella can cause some of the symptoms you've had and can be treated with antibiotics, but sometimes we don't treat with antibiotics because it can delay the passage of that bacteria from the gut. and make it even longer. So we sometimes won't treat it, particularly if it's mild.
Yeah, and often with salmonella, we only give the antibiotics in the severe cases where someone has to go to the hospital. So if you're able, hopefully you're feeling better, but as long as it turns the corner and you're keeping yourself hydrated, then antibiotics are usually not indicated.
Yeah. When are antibiotics? When do you recommend antibiotics, Christy, though, for patients with diarrhea? What are the couple things that you recommend potentially consider?
What I consider instead of antibiotics or
when?
When
do you think that you think for your patients, well, this was something I might give antibiotics for?
Okay. So if it's prolonged or unusual and we do a stool culture, which is one way to tease that out, and if it's salmonella and someone's in the hospital, so a baby who's required mm-hmm. to be in the hospital, mm-hmm. we often will recommend antibiotics in those situations, but very rarely.
Yeah. And the only time I think about it is, you know, when you're traveling. If you get really bad diarrhea that lasts more than a day while you're traveling, there's this called traveler's diarrhea, and sometimes that can benefit from a short course of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. But again, most cases don't.
And the biggest thing is drink fluids, drink some Gatorade, take small sips, and try to turn the corner by keeping yourself well hydrated.
What's next, Julie, for our next house call?
I am 72 years old, and I noticed a pea-sized lump along the top of my second toe. It moves around when I push on it, but it doesn't hurt. I asked a doctor to take a look at it, and she said it was a ganglion cyst. We decided just to watch it since it isn't bothering me, but I'd like to know what you guys recommend.
Well, a ganglion cyst is a big word, but it's another fluid-filled cyst that can happen along your tendon. And if it's moving and it's not bothering you, then often we do recommend watching it. There's some different treatment options, none of which work very well.
Yeah, we used to call this the kind of the Bible cyst because
that's right.
You remember that? I don't know, Christy, but
yep.
I learned in medical school that when you had this little cyst on your hand, what they would do is they'd take the old-time docs, they would take the Bible, and they'd come down and smash it on the top of the hand, and it would go squish, go everywhere, and that was the treatment for it. We don't recommend that nowadays, particularly on your toe. We don't want you to smash your toe there, but it suggests that these things are usually not dangerous. And only when they hurt do we really have to treat them.
And the treatment options don't work very well. You can inject them or try to pull the fluid out, or doctors can do that, but often it will come back. You can have surgery to remove it if it's really bothering you, but that has its own complications, and it still might grow back.
Yeah, and because it's a tendon, you don't really want your primary care doctor typically kind of mucking around with this cyst like you might others because it actually can get infected. It does have to usually be excised frequently by an orthopedic surgeon. So my recommendation is don't look at it.
If
it's not bothering
you,
don't look at it. It's on your toe. It's far enough away. Move on.
All right. What do we have next, Julie?
I'm a 67-year-old, very healthy woman. I went to my doctor for my yearly pap, and she said I don't need one anymore. Is this true?
Yes. Yes. Well, we're glad that you are a healthy woman. And at 67 years old, what your doctor has told you is true. The United States Preventive Services Task Force, which is one of the groups in our nation that looks at the data and provides recommendations about prevention, does recommend against routine pap smears for people over 65 who are of normal health and have had normal pap smears in the past.
Yeah, you know, particularly this idea of having the normal ones. If you've had normal pap smears for a number of years or every other year for a number of times, cervical cancer is a slow-growing cancer. It doesn't happen quickly, and the changes on it, that's why the pap smear can pick it up early. On the other hand, if you were doing great for a number of years and all of a sudden you started having some bleeding, well, that would be a whole different circumstance. But that doesn't sound like that our listener is like that. This sounds like someone who's really been doing healthy.
Yeah. So if your doctor has reviewed your history and recommended against pap smears, that we are in agreement with that.
Julie, I think we have time for one more house call.
I am 40 years old, and I have eczema. This gets worse in the fall and winter, and thankfully steroid creams help. But over the last year or two, I've been getting it on my eyelids. Aquaphor or Vaseline helps some, but I would need steroid on my eyelids to make it go away. I'm worried about side effects or causing cataracts from steroid cream. What would you recommend?
Yeah, you're a smart listener. This is a great question.
I mean,
these are the things that we would worry about here as well.
Absolutely. So there are some increased risks of using steroids around your eyes. And so that should be said that there is some association for people who respond a certain way to steroids. People, doctors call them steroid sensitive people.
So typically one can use some mild hydrocortisone cream or even 2.5%, particularly on a short-term basis for a week or two, very safely.
Right. If you're using the really low-dose stuff that you can get over the counter, like Cordate, hydrocortisone, any of that that you get over the counter, it's pretty hard to hurt yourself. But I still tell people, if you were going to do it on your eyes, to do it very minimally with that lowest dose stuff under the guidance of a doctor and do it only for a few days.
Well, that's going to conclude what we can talk about on your health today. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. Christy, we had a chance to look at x-rays and the syrinx and talk about this ganglion.
We had a little bit to talk about stopping pap smears after age 65 if you're healthy.
And finally, maybe using steroid creams low dose for short term for eczema, even on the eyes. And hopefully next time you can send us your own questions and we'll talk about them on Your Health. You can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can send them to us at 966-8081 or visit us at yourhealthradio.org.
And you can follow us on Twitter. We would like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. James Pagel. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll talk to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.